Coming up on Tech Nation, the science of popularity. Senior editor at The Atlantic, Derek Thompson, joins me to talk about how popularity works today as well as in days gone by. The tech has changed, the elements remain the same. Then on Tech Nation Health, our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, talks about the future of aging, longevity, and technology in the near and more distant future. And on Biotech Nation, biotech is working on our senescent cells. We start producing them relatively early. What if we cleared them out of our systems? All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
I'm loving every article I read about IBM's much-publicized technology breakthrough. The media generally describe it as the ability to store data in a single atom, but frankly, that's for general consumption. It's actually the ability to direct a single atom to be in one magnetic state or another, to have it remain in that state, and then to be able to detect which state it's in. When you say it that way, it doesn't sound like much, which is why you might call a description which reads, "the ability to store data in a single atom," a whole lot of hype. It does not mean that there's a single atom in which you could store a Netflix file, or a Word document, or your email. Well, at least not yet anyway. So for the time being, and for some time to come, it's a fantastic breakthrough to be able to deliberately get an atom to be in one of two magnetized states, to observe that the atom stays in that state unless tampered with, and to be able to detect which magnetic state the atom is in. You might wonder why this has computer scientists and engineers dancing in the streets, or at the very least, whistling happily at their computer desks and texting their friends. It's pretty simple, and I'll tell you why. Computer scientists and engineers know that every bit of digital storage that has ever been built was built on the ability to make something physical be in one of two different states, that the states would stay that way, and that technology could detect which state it was in. IBM's breakthrough means that decades of that know-how can be applied all over again. If you haven't already guessed it, you should know that this two stable states with ability to both detect and set approach to storage technology is in some form or another at the base of the storage in every laptop or computer you've ever owned or used, on every cell phone and smartphone you've ever owned or used, and in every one of those USB memory sticks which are scattered all over your life, from your office to your computer bag to the junk drawer in your kitchen. To be sure, there's plenty of work to be done here yet. But when engineers say, this is now a previously solved problem, it's like a wide receiver who catches the football, turns, and realizes he's got an open field run. The truth is, engineers can take anything that takes on two different states and make a data storage system. And as with so many things, size matters. That single atom, which can be in two different states, which we call 0 and 1, for IBM, it can now be done in a single atom. On your hard drive, the material it takes to store that 0 or 1, it takes some 100,000 atoms. Yep, do the math. In digital storage, as in golf, a low score is a very good thing. At the same time, while technology is getting tinier, humans are still just about the same size. If I gave you a USB drive that was 1/100,000th of the ones we have now, well, you get the point. So yes, size matters. In fact, our size also matters. So when that day comes, when a 1 and a 0 can be stored in something even smaller than an atom, given how big we are, we might not care. But actually, I think we will. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic and author of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in the Age of Distraction. Then on Tech Nation Health, our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, talks about the future of aging, longevity, and technology in the near and more distant future. And on Biotech Nation, Unity Biotechnology's Dr. Nathaniel David talks about accumulating senescent cells over our lives. What if we could clear them? When I started reading Derek Thompson's book, Hitmakers, I realized that I didn't really understand popularity, as in the nature of popularity, its very definition. So I asked him, what is popularity?
We're starting with the easy ones.
Oh, good.
What is popularity is a great question. I think you can break it down into two categories. The first category would be attention. It's what we pay attention to. But the second category is appeal. It's what we like. It's what we love. And we don't always like and love that which we pay attention to. I think about this in terms of TV ratings. Sometimes the shows with the highest TV ratings are sometimes hate-watched. People watch that show, they tune in, but they despise the thing that they're looking at, whether it's the news or sometimes even a reality show. And so popularity isn't just what we pay attention to, it's also what we love. And this is a book that's very much about the psychology of appeal, the psychology of why we like what we like, but it's also about the economic markets that sometimes determine that which we pay attention to. So I try to keep both in mind.
Well, certainly the economic markets will at some point create popularity so that the economics can flow. And at other times, they chase the popularity so that they can monetize it.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that, for example, in the history of the news industry, we've gone from a period of relative scarcity in the middle of the 20th century. You had a handful of television stations and radio stations that had the power to reach tens of millions of people. But now the power of broadcast is democratized, and there are Twitter accounts and news feeds and Facebook pages, et cetera, that have the power to essentially reach just as many people. And so it's not so much that we live in a purely viral world where everything is social and it's all one-to-one and one-to-two shares, but rather we live in a world where the power of broadcast has been democratized. And so now you have individuals whose powers of attention and powers of appeal, both sides of popularity, are as large as some legacy media institutions.
And then you tell us, don't listen to this, it's gone viral. There's nothing viral about it.
One of the most fun chapters to write, actually, was the chapter called The Viral Myth. I think what's happened these days is that when something gets big out of nowhere, we say, oh, that's gone viral. We default to saying this. But viral has a very specific meaning in epidemiology. It means that I get you sick and you get two people sick and they get two people sick each. And this disease spreads over many, many, many generations of intimate shares. But there's another way that information spreads, and we're participating in it right now. It's a single source of news being broadcast to many people at once. The Super Bowl, for example, is a very famous, well-known broadcast. Nobody says of an advertisement in the Super Bowl, oh my God, that ad went viral in the Super Bowl. No, it was very clearly broadcast to 115 million people at once. So the question, I think, for people who are interested in popularity is, does information truly go viral, or do the biggest broadcasts determine popularity? And when data scientists now can actually study the spread of a Twitter post or a Facebook post or a viral YouTube video, it turns out that when you look at that information cascade, that map of the idea catching on, it looks much more like a series of broadcasts with sort of social tendrils than it looks like a pure disease spreading. So I would like us to sort of shift the way that we talk about the spread of information online from purely viral to broadcasts that we don't always see. And I call them dark broadcasts. And I think we live in a world that is dominated by dark broadcasts.
This is so important to understand because we've come from an era where if anything got broadcast, disseminated, it was all external. Newspapers, mm-hmm. the broadcast medium of which there were just a few channels and you couldn't even record it. You had to be there. Mm-hmm. And then it would kind of go into somebody talking to each other. Now we have all this electronics. It's like all this information they're accessing. We know they're accessing because we can see them right in front of us. All of this stuff is going on. Who's consuming it? What they're consuming? It's like we have no way to touch it.
In the 20th century and the 19th century, I think you could cleanly divide media technologies into one of two categories. You had social technologies, like the telephone. I call one person to talk to one person, to have an intimate conversation. And the television, a broadcast technology, many people tuning in to watch the same linear programming. But what's interesting about new technologies, like Instagram or Snapchat or Facebook or Twitter, is that they are some weird combination of the social and the broadcast. Facebook, for example, is a modern telephone network for a lot of people. It's a way to keep in touch with far-flung family the same way you might have kept in touch 15 years ago with that Saturday afternoon phone call. But it's also one of the most important ways for news companies like The Atlantic or The New York Times to reach their largest audience. So one of the things I think that makes Facebook unpredictable and makes it weird but also so fascinating is that it is a global newspaper, but it's also a global telephone network. It's this fascinating combination of the social and the broadcast. And because social and broadcast are mixing together sometimes, we forget where information comes from. And we don't necessarily seek out its provenance the same way that we might when we pick up a piece of newspaper that's delivered to our front door and say, aha, I know exactly where this came from.
Provenance. We live in an age now where facts are being distributed all over, which really aren't true. They're not facts. They're misinformation where we also have actual facts, actual truth being called untrue, all floating around out there. And we can see that, but we have no measurement for who believes what.
Yeah, I'll say two things to that. First, you said provenance twice. I'll say it three times. Provenance. This is a very popular concept in the art history world. When someone claims to have found a new Monet painting, for example, a smart art historian or a smart person from Christie's or Sotheby's is going to say, all right, where did it come from? Who sold it to who? In what museum did this particular parchment hang? And you look back to see exactly where it came from. It would be wonderful, I think, if more people had the exact same approach to information that they find online, to seek out the original broadcasters, seek out the original source. The second interesting thing that comes from that is that in many ways, any marketplace that is maximizing for attention has the risk of maximizing for the dark side of attention, which is that which is merely scandalous, which merely tells us what we want to believe, and therefore sidesteps this very important issue of truth. At the beginning of the newspaper business, the penny paper business in the 1800s, Benjamin Day, who was one of the first penny paper publishers, realized that the best way to get a bunch of people reading the New York Post wasn't to report the truth about local New York politics. It was to write columns to say that there were men who looked like bats who lived on the moon and Mars. So fake news is a lot older than Facebook. It's been with us for a long time, and it may unfortunately be a rather inherent characteristic of attention-seeking markets.
And you write, social media is structurally prejudiced toward outrage, emotional propaganda, and confirmation bias.
Yes.
It's all set there, primed to say, we're going to tell you what you want to know.
Yes.
Because that's what you want to know.
And it's always what, what we've wanted to know. You know, one of the themes of the book, I hope, is that all sorts of issues that we're dealing with today, like fake news, like sequelitis in Hollywood, the obsession with comic book movies, we've dealt with this before. History does not repeat, but my God, does it rhyme. And with this particular issue, you know, you look back to the things that people were writing about newspaper coverage in the 18th century, in the 19th century. It was the exact same concerns, that journalists weren't telling the truth, that readers didn't care about finding the truth. They just wanted to find that which was fun to read. I tell a story about George Gallup, famous now for his surname being Gallup Poling. He was a dissertation student at the University of Iowa, and he wanted to be a newspaper publisher, and he wanted to know what people read when they pick up a newspaper. So he had the clever idea of just going to their living rooms and asking them, "What do you read?" Point it out. In surveys, Des Moines readers would say, oh, they read the front page, they care about local news. But when he actually asked them and watched them read the newspaper, it turned out that the most popular thing among women was the fashion photography, and the most popular thing among men was the political cartoon by J.H. Darling. So we were Facebook readers long before Facebook existed. We wanted to read the funnies and the comics and things that we would already agree with and would make us laugh over local government news for a long time.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in the Age of Distraction. I was really interested when I read your book about what makes a hit. I kept going again and again through each story because they're all nuanced. And one of the things that absolutely hits me is serendipity about how something becomes popular. And I think one of the best examples is behind the defining rock and roll song, Bill Haley and the Comets' Rock Around the Clock. We can all sing it now, but we won't. it was born to be popular.
It does feel like it was born to be popular, and it was not. This is one of my favorite stories from the book as well, so I'm so glad you brought it up. The long story short is that in 1954, the song comes out as a B-side. It doesn't
explain to some of our younger listeners what a B-side is.
A B-side is the other side of that physical record. The B-side means the label doesn't necessarily think it's going to be the best song that they've got. And indeed, it didn't do very well. It charted on Billboard for, I think, exactly 1 week.
The A-side?
The B-side did. Rock Around the Clock did chart for 1 week on Billboard with a lot of label backing. But mostly, it was just forgotten. It didn't do nearly as well as many other songs by the band Bill Haley and his Comets. So if you just end your investigation of this song in 1954, you're like, all right, Rock Around the Clock is going to be forgotten to history like so many thousands of rock and roll songs from the 1950s. But then in 1955, a 10-year-old boy named Peter Ford is one of the few thousand people who has bought this long-forgotten record. And Peter Ford's father is Glenn Ford, who's a famous Hollywood star. And Glenn Ford is in this movie named Blackboard Jungle, which is about juvenile delinquency in the 1950s. And the director of the movie, Richard Brooks, comes over to the Ford's estate in Los Angeles, and he tells his star, I need a new song to kick off this movie about juvenile delinquency. And Glenn Ford says, well, look, I only listen to Hawaiian folk, so I am not going to be the right person to kick off this movie. But my son, Peter Ford, listens to a lot of weird music. Maybe you should ask him. So this 10-year-old boy, this fifth grader, hands the director of Blackboard Jungle a stack of records, one of which is a record by Bill Haley and his Comets. And the song Rock Around the Clock plays at the beginning of Blackboard Jungle, in the middle of Blackboard Jungle, and at the end of Blackboard Jungle. And it's only then, 2 weeks after the movie comes out, that the song hits number one on Billboard, the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one on Billboard, and the second best-selling song of all time in American history. So, you know, you, as a journalist, we want to explain outcomes as if they're inevitable. We want to say that someone who becomes president became president because that's the only way it could have happened, or that some movie or song that becomes a hit had to become a hit because it had the inherent qualities of hitness. But so how do you grapple with Rock Around the Clock? The song sounded the exact same in 1954 and in 1955. And in 1954, it was a flop. In 1955, it was the hit of the century. And the answer to this, the two answers that I give, are one, that distribution is more important than content in predicting popularity, and this song's placement in the movie was just the perfect kismet for its being delivered to this teenage generation. And second, that perseverance is the only antidote to a culture of probabilities, where nothing that you make has a 100% chance of becoming a hit. You have to keep batting, 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 and hoping that eventually you will get the break that Bill Haley did.
And now I must ask the question all our listeners want answered. What was the number one song of all time?
The number one song of all time is by Bing Crosby. It's called White Christmas.
Oh. Number
and
two
it's so
is
unfair. And it's so unfair because White Christmas, people bought every single year. Christmas, like it had this sort of trigger where, you know, it's December. We got to buy the Bing Crosby song. So, yes, Rock Around the Clock, you could say, is the best-selling non-seasonally devoted song in American history.
I just love looking at these hits. I mean, they're just sort of amazing. Star Wars. Mm-hmm. He just didn't say, okay, here's my script. Here's, you know, George Lucas.
I have it all planned out.
Got it all planned out. Ron Howard, you know. Oh, is that Opie kid? Come on over. No.
Yeah.
Didn't happen that way.
It's, yeah. One of the chapters is about how George Lucas wrote Star Wars. And it was, for all the people out there trying to write their own world-conquering hit, just as agonizing for him as it probably is for you, dear listener. You know, he wanted to make a totally different movie. He wanted to make Flash Gordon, his favorite comic when he was a kid. And he asked the owners of the Flash Gordon comic, can I please turn this into a movie? And they said, we'd prefer some Italian director direct it. So he's turned down and he gets steak with his friend, another director named Francis Ford Coppola. And Coppola tells George Lucas, just make your own space fantasy, write your own thing. So he writes his first script, and it's terrible. And he writes his second script, and it's terrible. And the third script is terrible. But he eventually realizes that what he should do is take all of his favorite references from the comic book universe and throw them into the same stew and then make the sort of the shape of the story a very familiar metamyth called the hero's journey, that this idea that Joseph Campbell came up with that says that all the great hero journeys, all the great stories from all time, like Jesus and Buddha, are essentially the same myth of the normal person who goes an extraordinary journey and defeats a nemesis who's intimately related to his origin story and comes back to the world as a hero. And so it's only through this incredibly complicated process that George Lucas finally creates essentially the sundae that is Star Wars. And he said, this isn't one ice cream flavor or another. It's all my favorite ice cream flavors together. This movie is a sundae. And the reason I love this story is that it upholds one of the central themes of the book, which is, yes, we like originality. We enjoy novelty. We like discovering new things. But we really like these new things when we can use them to discover familiarities. People are traveling to a galaxy far, far away, but what are they actually watching? They're watching a Western. They're watching The Lord of the Rings, the Harry Potter story, the journey of Luke Skywalker, the average nobody with no parents who, against all odds, achieves absolute heroic greatness. And that's what we want from our stories, whether they're based here on planet Earth or many galaxies away. We want to feel like we are living through the heroes on the screen.
And what's so essential in your analysis is that there is something familiar about this, even though we thought, well, we've never seen anything like this before. Mm-hmm. So we really don't want things that are all that new.
No, we like things that are optimally new. We like familiar surprises. We like new songs with familiar chord structures, new movies that take characters that we know and love or meta narratives that we know and love and dress them up in new outfits. I'll name a movie that seems to many people to probably have nothing to do with Star Wars. Zootopia. Zootopia was one of the biggest movies of 2016, just an absolutely lovely movie about a world populated by anthropomorphic animals. But once again, it's about a bumpkin bunny who comes from the ordinary world and goes to this new metropolis of talking animals and goes through this fascinating journey whereby she defeats the ultimate enemy and comes back to her original world as the hero. it is the Joseph Campbell hero's journey. It's on the one hand, seems to be nothing like Star Wars, and yet is the same meta-narrative. So
look for it in a grocery store near you.
Yes,
it's everywhere.
Exactly. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. There are patterns to why we like what we like, and we love finding new ways to wind our way home.
Now, a second myth you hope to dispel is that quality is not destiny.
Mm-hmm. I think it's easy for people who are creatives, who are innovators, entrepreneurs, to hope that if they make something that they think is good enough, that it will self-distribute, that it will just automatically
connect. If
we build
it, they will come.
Exactly. If we build it, they will come. But here's some really good evidence that quality is not enough. When a new song comes out by a major label, they'll often give the song to an online song testing company named Hit Predictor or Sound Out. And these companies will play the new song for a couple hundred, a thousand people, and ask these people who have never heard the song before, know nothing about it, to rate its pure catchiness. And what they'll say is, if it passes a certain threshold of catchiness, say an 80, between 0 and 100, if it passes 80, then it is guaranteed to be a hit if it gets enough radio exposure and label marketing. But for every 100 songs that are hit quality, only about 5 of them will actually receive that gift of exposure and luck and marketing. So above a certain level of quality or songwriting catchiness, what matters to become a hit is not more quality, but rather more exposure, more distribution. Distribution matters more than content. And so the summary that I would say for this is that quality is a necessary but insufficient element of any product to become a hit.
We actually see that in many areas. I remember a European venture capitalist I was talking to last summer, and he said, look it, you can have the best technology in the world and a mediocre team, and I won't give them any money. But you give me an okay technology and a team with at least one star, maybe multiple stars, I'll give you money and they will succeed.
Yeah, betting on people over products sometimes
is
a smart thing to do. There's a story in the book about Cheers. When Cheers came out in the 1980s, I believe it was the 75th most popular of the 77 shows that aired that season. It was not well attended
at
all. I mean,
Star Trek, another one. It was like on the cancel block.
Basically,
you know,
ignored. Right. I mean, if a show came out today, there are about 450 original scripted shows that come out every year now. If you're number 440, you are absolutely getting canceled after a few weeks.
I'm speaking with Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in the Age of Distraction. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, it's all about aging, from how early it starts to what tech and biotech can do about it. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Derek Thompson, the author of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in the Age of Distraction.
But they keep Cheers on because they really like the writers and they really like the characters. And they keep Cheers on, and eventually Cheers becomes the top 10 show that we all know that it became. And the gift to NBC, the channel that Cheers was on, is twofold. Not only does the success of Cheers create the possibility of Frasier, a spinoff from Cheers, but also there's this little show, a show called, well, initially called The Seinfeld Chronicles, that now we merely know as Seinfeld. Seinfeld was not particularly popular until it aired in the early 1990s after Cheers. So this initial decision to wait on Cheers and allow the writers to develop storylines and develop characters paid off so massively for NBC. It does sometimes make sense to bet on people over the immediate obviousness of a product success.
Now, this also goes beyond music and media and all of that. It also goes on to design and products. You talk about something called, is it Maya, M-A-Y-A?
Maya, yeah, M-A-Y-A. Most advanced yet acceptable. This was the grand theory of everything from Raymond Loewy, the father of industrial design. And for people who haven't heard of Raymond Loewy, please just enter him into a Google search bar. This guy designed the most famous car design of the 1950s, the modern train, the modern tractor. He designed the pencil sharpener that looks like an egg that everyone's seen in those classrooms. He even designed the logos for Exxon and Shell, the interior habitat of the first NASA space station. His idea. Just an absolute genius in understanding what people wanted from products just across the continuum. And his thesis was, we are torn between two opposing ideas. We are, on the one hand, neophilic. We love new things. We love discovering new songs and movies and products and clothes. And we're neophobic. We hate products and clothes and movies and music that's too new. And so he was this master at designing for the optimally new, creating new shells and new designs that would winkingly remind consumers of the product that it was replacing while still supplying that key element of discovery and novelty.
And we see it in technology as well. Every so often, incredible product. We say it was ahead of its time, and the designers or the builders or the people creating it, they just weren't ready for it.
Right. Yeah.
Well, certainly, you know, the background music playing throughout your book as we read it is not exactly how do we create a hit. You know, how do you go about creating popularity? Mm-hmm. And there are some answers to that. As you wait for the serendipity.
Yeah, I think that on the one hand, yes, like cultural markets are chaotic and it's difficult to predict exactly, you know, what first name is going to be the single most popular first name in 2019, like exactly what artist is going to have the best-selling song in 2019. But there still is science. There's a science to understanding why we like what we like and a science to understanding why certain things catch on online and other emotions don't. So the way that I think about the predictiveness of the book is to compare cultural markets to weather. In weather, we used to think that it was gods that made the sun rise in the east and set in the west and put the moon and the stars in the sky and rained when the deities were upset. And now we know about water cycles and why the rain happens, and we know about the revolution of the earth and why the sun and moon come out when they do. But knowing all of this and sort of evicting God from this particular space of weather doesn't make us perfectly oracular when it comes to predicting the weather in San Francisco or Washington, D.C. in 3 weeks. The weather systems are too chaotic to perfectly predict temperature in a specific metropolitan area too far ahead of time. So understanding the science makes us smarter about anticipating what's about to come, but it doesn't make us perfect oracles. And in the same way, I think understanding the science of cultural markets makes us better producers of culture, makes us smarter consumers of culture. But I do not want to promise that this book is going to turn us into oracles.
Gee, do you think your book's going to be really popular?
I certainly hope so. Yeah.
I hope the serendipity of showing up on this show.
I just stumbled into this
there
little
show. There you stumbled
down
the hallway. I said, come on in, Derek. There you go. Derek, come back and see us again. This has been terrific. There's lots more to talk about.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
My guest today is Derek Thompson. His book is Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in the Age of Distraction. It's published by Penguin Press. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. On today's Tech Nation Health, we hear from our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft.
I thought we'd talk about the future of aging and longevity and technology and where those things are heading in the near and more distant future. Everyone wants to live long lives. Some folks want to live a long, long time. There's the whole longevity movement. I'm more interested in health span rather than lifespan. You know, it'd be great to be 100, 120, but still have my marbles and able to get around and interact and contribute to society. And I think there are a lot of technologies that are on the cusp or already here that are going to really change what it's like to be, you know, what used to be quote-unquote elderly. Some of those are the technologies coming to our connected homes. How do our homes track our health and wellness? I have an Amazon Echo and a Google Home, and you can do smart things like, you know, play the music, order an Uber, tell me a joke. But these are increasingly become health sensors in our connected homes. You know, how much insulin should I take? Reorder my medication? Or help, I've fallen and can't get up. So our smart homes will help younger and older folks be more connected and bring us information and safety elements as well. And our connected homes are increasingly filled with smart robotics. So one of the issues that unfortunately doesn't let folks stay at home as they get older and can't do their activities of daily living can be augmented by robotics, whether it's the Roomba that cleans your floor or the telepresent robot that can enable you to interact with your grandkids or increasingly technologies that will help you get around the house. Some of you might have seen folks, those chairs that help folks get up who can't otherwise. We'll see increasingly robotics enable folks to get around who would be otherwise stuck in a wheelchair. We're friends with Dean Kamen, who's a famous inventor who's known for inventing the Segway, but his primary invention before that was the iBot. This is a robot wheelchair that enables someone to stand who's normally in a wheelchair and get around. Those are getting cheaper and smaller, even to the point where it won't be a robotic wheelchair, but it will be a robot that you wear, this idea of an exoskeleton. So there's companies near us here in San Francisco called Exobotics, which have made wearable exoskeletons, first for the military, for folks who have to carry heavy weights, but now being applied to folks, for example, with paraplegia. They're paralyzed from the waist down. They can wear an exoskeleton and walk. Very transformative for the severely disabled, but imagine older folks who just can't get around as much or have a weakness in one leg from a stroke. This will enable them to get around the house or climb Mount Kilimanjaro.
Well, that's a big thing for people who are aging. It's like suddenly they don't feel they can go out with their family. They don't feel they can go anyplace with their grandchildren because I might fall down or I can't walk more than this many steps. This is truly transformative.
Right. And our centered homes help us do that when we're home. Even Wi-Fi can now pick up vital signs from individuals. You don't need to be wearing anything. The old help I fall and I can't get up bracelet can be augmented by your smartwatch or just the sensors in your home or when you're out and about. And of course, now you can get out and about with technologies like Uber or Lyft. Even both of those companies have been working with healthcare systems and hospitals to enable folks to get to doctor visits. Or there have been pilots with Uber Health to press a button on the app and bring a nurse to give a flu shot to an elderly person who can't easily get to the pharmacy or the physician. So there's the whole blending of these technologies for sort of the day-to-day elements of health and prevention and managing disease. But a big issue with aging often is cognitive issues, right? As folks get older, our cognitive abilities do go down, and there's, with the aging generation issues with Alzheimer's and dementia, we can now see some of these technologies impact that as well. For example, again, your smart connected Amazon Echo or Google Home can help give you feedback, or your hearing aid. A lot of older folks have issues with hearing. Those are going to be more and more embedded with artificial intelligence. They're going to remind you, hey, Daniel, you're lost down the street. Here's how you get home. Or, who am I talking to? Oh, yeah, that's Moira. I can tell just by listening to her voice or give you other guidance that can be helpful, again, for folks with normal cognitive abilities or others. And even engage us in mental games that can help maintain or improve cognition. There's several studies and companies developing brain games, not just doing puzzles, but that can really measure your brain-computer interface sensored brain to improve and trigger ways to improve everything from multitasking to learning a new language.
I mean, it's so important because the older we live, and we've really been working on, you know, increasing this longevity, the more we're liable to get dementia or some, it could be from mild to very extreme dementia. Clearly, the earlier we can diagnose this, the more we can bring medical technologies as well as exercises or whatever in. It's so crucial to do it early. And these kinds of technologies are really going to put us ahead there.
Well, an example, we want to be sort of reactive in health and medicine, proactive. So there are now actually little video games as well as blood tests and brain scans that can pick up who is likely to get dementia 10 or 15 years later. Now, unfortunately, there's not many drugs that are very effective right now for, let's say, Alzheimer's. But let's say we can predict, based on genetics, blood tests, video games, who's going to get dementia 10 or 15 years later. Maybe we can start to be proactive, whether that's physical exercise, certain diets, or some of these new drugs that are in clinical trials today that show some success in stopping or reversing plaques in the brain. So this whole combination, just like you might take a statin if you have high cholesterol or risk of cardiovascular disease, by using some of these technologies will help folks before they develop
preventative
disease.
Preventative, if you will, or
right.
At least stalling. Yeah,
I like to call it stage zero medicine, picking up and treating the disease essentially before it's even happened. And I think for the aging population, we want, again, to be much more proactive before they have the fall, predicting that's going to happen, providing cognitive and other supports before they really need it. And all that can enable folks to live at home, age in place as it is, not end up in a nursing home, stay connected to friends and family. A major issue with older populations is social isolation, and these technologies that connect us, whether it's Facebook or virtual reality or your kids visiting you on a robot, can help folks stay more connected, healthy, and mentally attuned as well. There's a whole realm of other technologies that can help us potentially live longer, from understanding the genetics of aging and some of the new drugs in development from companies like Calico and companies like Human Longevity Incorporated, trying to understand your genome, your microbiome, your other data to figure out how to keep you on the healthy track and aging in the most optimal way, and potentially finding drugs, maybe things like resveratrol and red wine that might change the aging pathway. And we're seeing this idea of systems medicine, systems biology, companies like Aravail and Human Longevity Incorporated, where you can take a look at your microbiome, your genome, your full body MRI, your genetic, your digital exhaust, connect those with coaches and help you, again, be much more proactive on the prevention side, no matter what stage of life you're in, or if you have a disease, to manage it in smarter, more personalized ways. So the blending of precision medicine and personalized medicine with aging and longevity are all kind of blended together.
And everything is focused so much now on the individuals. You are a person of one. I mean, we may take your data and move it with everybody else's to understand it, but you are the person we're treating. You are the person we're helping. And the idea of a medical treatment versus life assistance treatment, you know, that's merging as well. It's a really interesting technology issue.
And we want to personalize all these things. But part of this personalization is learning from others. For example, there are several studies looking at the genes of supercentenarians, folks who've been 100 years old or older and still doing quite well. What are the genes that contribute to their longevity? How can you then apply some of those genetic and other potential elements to preventing disease from progressing earlier in life? So while we want to individualize therapy, we can also start to crowdsource genomics, digital health information. All these things can help us be much more tuned and proactive and preventative at an individualized level. I think part of the future of aging and longevity is to be proactive early in life, to start to learn both your genetic risks and others, maybe based on where you live, on your past habits, and how to leverage some of these new tools, whether it's wearables that can help nudge you in the right direction, to smarter diets that are tuned based on your genome and microbiome, to potentially taking us, you know, 10, 15 years from now, there'll be a whole new suite of technologies, some enabled by synthetic biology and nanotech, that really may let us push those barriers, which today are about 120 in terms of the longest folks have lived, to really bring us, again, not just longevity, but health spans that are bringing us to a future where both as individuals and in society, we're aging in smart ways that enable us not to just be 120, but valued members of the population and community as well.
I've heard that expressed as, you know, 120 really good years and kind of a bad last 2 weeks, so you can say goodbye to everybody.
That's another issue. A whole other topic is What happens when we can do more and more of those last months of life, and how do we die well? How do we even use technology to help folks in hospice or let their wishes be known? Big issues there as we have hopefully older and healthier populations. What's the retirement age? How many times are you married? How many careers do you have? All those things are impacted by this, including the population of the planet.
Well, Daniel, such a pleasure. Love to see you next time.
Thanks, Mara.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine and chair for medicine at Singularity University. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, biotech works on aging. Dr. Nathaniel David is the founder and CEO of Unity Biotechnology. In our pre-interview, we talked about senescent cells. So I asked Ned, what does senescent mean?
Well, senescent is a term often sort of used as a sort of synonym for being old. But
as in senile.
As in senile. However, we use the term to mean something a little different. When we use the word senescent, we mean cells that are no longer able to divide. And I don't mean aren't dividing. I literally mean can't divide no matter what you do to them.
So a normal healthy cell, it gets divided, it gets created, it lives its life, and it stops dividing. What happens to that cell normally in the body?
So we don't know precisely what happens to all cells when they become senescent, a subset of them persist in your body and accumulate as you age. So children, while they can make senescent cells, do not accumulate them. And older people, when humans reach the age of 30, these cells begin to accumulate more and more every year in tissues throughout your body. And as they accumulate, these cells do something rather naughty. They begin secreting a bunch of factors, these pro-inflammatory factors that wind
inflammation
up,
very bad.
Yeah, inflammation generally very bad thing, although in certain cases required. However, when it is persistent and not associated with infection, that's sort of something we think of as chronic sterile inflammation. And one of the characteristics of being old is if you go into the tissues of an old person, they display chronic sterile inflammation throughout their body. And we believe that these senescent cells are the source of much of that chronic sterile inflammation.
So you've developed some compounds, set of compounds, and you've actually looked in animal studies to see what happens if you remove these senescent cells.
That's correct. So we have done this over the arc of a normal animal's life, as one of our first experiments. We published that paper in Nature in February of this year, 2016. And what that paper showed is that these mice benefited tremendously by having these cells cleared. And I will confess that when we first did the experiment, and this was with our collaborators at the Mayo Clinic, they created this strain of mice. We didn't know if when we cleared the cells, you'd come back in the next day and see a bunch of dead mice in the cage. But in fact, the opposite is true. These mice wind up with delayed kidney disease, delayed cardiac dysfunction, tremendously delayed osteoporosis, and the animals live approximately 35% longer in terms of a median age. And we are making drugs now to try to do that very same thing in human beings.
What I think is fascinating is the idea, and this, of course, at this point needs more scientific study, is what is the contribution of these senescent cells accumulating in the body? What, in fact, do you think they might be doing?
We find that these cells mediate their bad effects through all of these factors they secrete. In fact, and the reason we know this is we can actually get rid of the cells and simply take the media that these cells were soaking in, the liquid the cells were growing in, the growth medium, and pour that growth medium without the cells on top of, say, other cells, like cells that are trying to become muscle or trying to become breast
healthy
milk cells.
Yeah. Healthy cells.
And we see that the secretions from these cells are able to dent the ability of normal cellular functions. that experiment's a very simple one, but actually really makes the point that it's not the cell itself. It's not the fact that the cell doesn't divide. It's the things these cells secrete.
They're not dead. They're just not dividing anymore.
Yeah. We think of them as the worst possible neighbors you could have. Right.
Well, let's not forget people used to die at 30 and 40. That was very typical. We're living much longer.
So one of the questions I often ask or people often ask me is, why would nature evolve a system to give you osteoarthritis or to make you need reading glasses? Or they give me a whole host of things. And I'll say, well, nature didn't get a vote. After reproductive age, nature doesn't know what happens. This is all random mistake in which evolution never got to watch.
They never got to make a decision. They didn't expect us to be sitting around at this age doing all these things. So here we are making all these differences. And of course, here in the United States, just recently they talked about how, hey, we've moved the age at which we can expect to die if you're alive today up by 3 years. And it was like, really? You know, for women, 89? It's like this is just marching away from where we expected women just a century ago to live in what we would consider a civilized, healthy society. So things are moving, and this is a very interesting place to look. I think one of the things that I was impressed with when we spoke before the show is, and I'm asking you, where are you going with this? What are the first things? You said, well, you know, aging isn't a disease. We can't go to the FDA to fix aging. So your strategy has to do with what we would consider frequently the conditions that are associated with aging. So where are you going first?
So our first drug, which if biology and chemistry cooperates, will be in people by the end of 2017, is going to be in osteoarthritis of the knee. So people who their knees hurt, they've lost cartilage, and also patients who have senescent cells in the knee. So it's one of the things we do at work is about once a week, a Federal Express package arrives with a knee in it. Because people
getting, I do not wish to work at your place,
yes,
but that's okay.
And the
you
knee,
work on it.
Yeah, the knee is alive when it shows up in ice, and we harvest cells from these knees. And these are from patients who have undergone total knee replacement because they have osteoarthritis of the knee. And so what we do is we harvest the cells from there, and we can then test our compounds. And what we found is we have compounds that can selectively target and eliminate senescent cells in cartilage of sick knees. And when we put these compounds into mice that have the disease, we can not only halt the disease, but actually start growing new cartilage. We can get rid of pain in the mouse. And then when we actually take human tissue from these diseased knees and soak it in our drug, the cartilage that was sick and couldn't make new collagen winds up making new collagen again. Almost as though these senescent cells were hanging out in your sick knee, blocking the ability of the remaining good citizen cells to work. And when you clear them out, the system restores to its normal function.
Where next?
After that, we predict glaucoma. So this is a disease of the eye in which senescent cells accumulate in this meshwork that's at the front of the eye. And it causes the pressure inside the eye to build up and up and up. And as the pressure rises, it actually causes senescence in the back of the eye, which is why you have a problem, which gives rise to death of retinal cells. And so what we know already is that if you can't make senescent cells, you can block the death of the retina. So we're making compounds that you place into the eye that impact both intraocular pressure, and we think will lower it, but also protect the retina from further loss. So osteoarthritis, there's no cure for it, right? It's just something that when you get old, you're told you're getting old, your knees hurt, suck it up.
You've got osteoarthritis.
Yeah, I've got it. So I'm turning 49 this year. I've lost cartilage in my back. But glaucoma, on the other hand, is a condition in which many patients, we have a way to treat them. And we treat them by giving them drugs, you know, once or twice a day that lower the intraocular pressure. We think we can make a drug in which you would inject this drug once, maybe a year, as opposed to, say, once a day or twice a day, and lower the intraocular pressure essentially quasi-permanently because we think we've removed the elements from the biology that are driving the problem.
So you're not saying, well, this is systemic. I'll take it and it'll get into my bloodstream and go anywhere it needs to go. What we're saying is this is where your problem is. We're going to deliver the compound to that area.
That's correct. And we've made that decision for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that senescent cells do good things too. So this idea that they are merely bad actors is an oversimplification. They facilitate wound healing. They're involved in body plan development during the development of the embryo. And obviously, they're an anti-cancer system. The notion of systematically going through and eradicating an entire cell population throughout your body is something that one should not take lightly. And so by doing local therapy first, in which we have a highly controlled volume in your body in which we do this process called senolysis, which is the death of senescent cells, we think we make the safety issues more manageable. We're also going after these indications because we have high confidence of the role of these cells in these diseases. So we have demonstrated experimentally, certainly for OA and hopefully very soon for glaucoma, that these cells are both necessary for the disease and possibly sufficient for the disease. And that, you know, those are heavy words for a biologist to throw around, necessary and sufficient. And if these are both necessary and sufficient and you clear them, well, guess what? You don't have disease anymore. And that's pretty cool.
You mentioned you were 49. This is not the first company you've been at, and certainly not the first company you founded or been one of the founders, and they've gone on to be sold to very reputable pharmaceutical firms. Is this any different in your experience than the other ones, which were in type 2 diabetes and far more recognized disease conditions?
Yeah. So, well, first, you know, I founded a lot of companies over the years. I've been doing it ever since grad school. So my first company, we sold to Takeda. We have an approved drug from that called Alogliptin. My second company struggled a little bit more. It's got a drug in phase 3. My third company, Kythera, has an approved drug called Kybella that addresses no grievous illness. It actually causes fat cells to explode. We sold that company last year to Allergan. That was a wonderful outcome in many ways. But Unity is without question the coolest biology I've gotten to work on in my entire career. And I've gotten to work on some pretty cool stuff, and it wasn't – my coolest stuff I've worked on wasn't even on that list because it didn't work, okay? I just listed for you all the companies that worked out and we transacted them or they went public. But if you just take a list of everything I've gotten to touch as a scientist over what? Has it been 30 years I've been a scientist? Because I started as a late teenager, right? Getting into the lab. This is the coolest thing, and it's been the greatest honor to work on it. And I just hope that myself and my team of awesome teammates is worthy of the responsibility we have to try to make this biology something that impacts human life.
Dr. Nathaniel David is the founder and CEO of Unity Biotechnology. More information is available at unitybiotechnology.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.